Hello and welcome to episode 2 of the Atomic Timekeeping Podcast, a podcast about the most accurate clocks ever made. My name is Greg Anderson, and I like talking about this stuff, and I hope you enjoy discussing some of these things with me. Today, I would like to talk about the technology of timekeeping that led us to a world where there is such a thing as an atomic clock. Now, to start off, I'm going to talk a little bit about measurement of frequencies. And let's talk a little bit about something like a piano. Now, a piano has all kinds of strings inside, right? So if you strike a key on a piano, the mechanism inside strikes a string inside the piano, and that string vibrates at a certain frequency, and that frequency creates a certain sound. And that sound should be a certain pitch. You want that note to be exactly a certain frequency so it sounds right. Some people have perfect pitch, and without any kind of measuring devices, they can tell whether that piano string is out of tune. And even the best pianos in the world have to be adjusted, tuned up, you know, maintained, so that they will consistently play the right note corresponding to the key that you've pressed. Okay, you know, things can get out of tune, sharp, flat, whatever. You want it to be consistent to play back that note. All right, so, well, there's something about consistency that's very important to timekeeping. I don't know the full history of timekeeping. I don't know who invented the 24-hour day or how far back that goes. I do know something about timekeeping in the last few hundred years. And what I do know is that for a long time, the best timekeeping was something that drove maybe a pendulum, either a spring or a weight that would drive a pendulum. So you had a clock with a pendulum swinging back and forth at a consistent rate, and you could use that to tell time. The mechanisms inside the clock would then display the time according to the movement of this pendulum. And this was a very good way to tell time, provided that your clock was on a stable surface. The only problem is that, let's say, after 1492, there's a lot of people trying to sail across so large oceans. And part of the way they navigate and part of the way they can tell where they are on the map is by comparing their relative position against the position of the sun in the sky. Now, using this navigation method, they could pretty much figure out how far north of the equator they were, but the east-west position was difficult unless you had some reference to compare against the movement of the sun relative to your ship. So, of course, they wanted some sort of timekeeping device. Well, you can't use a clock with a pendulum on a ship, because a ship is rocking back and forth, and that's going to keep the pendulum from going back and forth at a consistent rate. So this was a big problem. How do we tell time on a ship? We don't have accurate enough clocks here. Well, there was a big push to create some sort of timekeeping mechanism that would work well on a moving ship. And this was eventually accomplished in the mid-1700s. There was actually a big cash prize for the person who was able to develop this thing. They were known as marine chronometers, and they were able to, keep time, even on the ocean, with a moving ship. It's interesting to me that timekeeping is still very vital to precise navigation today. And in a future episode, I'll talk a little bit about the Global Positioning System, or GPS, which is highly dependent on timekeeping to help people navigate. So, you know, the master clock for those of us living on this planet is the Earth itself. The movement of the Earth is what determines how long one day is, and everything else we have is dependent on the length of a day. You know, a day is 24 hours, an hour is 60 minutes, a minute is 60 seconds, and this is how we tell the length of day. So astronomy, you know, a big part of timekeeping. And there are very sophisticated astronomical minds out there that can figure out the precise positions of celestial bodies relative to each other. You know, it's interesting. If you want to know the sunrise or sunset time in any given part of the world, on any given day for the next 100 years, there are places on the internet where you can just plug in your position and the date, and it'll tell you those things. People have figured this out. They know when eclipses are going to happen for the next however many years you're interested in. You know, people have figured this out. So I guess the simplest way to figure out, well, if you want to say, well, how long is 1 second? Well, here's what you do. You just measure the position of the sun when it reaches sort of a high noon position, the highest point in the sky in your location, okay? And then the next day, you figure out where that is again. Then you take that length of time and divide it by 86,400, and then that's how long a second is. Easy, right? Well, not for me. I couldn't do that. And, you know, the other problem with keeping time in that way, did you know that the Earth itself, the orbit, the rotation, is not entirely consistent? Now, it may be off by just fractions of a second from day to day, but these great astronomical minds are able to determine that. So, yeah, the Earth's movement is not consistent from day to day. So that's why there is something called Greenwich Mean Time that sort of takes an average of all the Earth's movement, and then they figure out time from there. But that's not really good enough for scientific experiments and navigation and things that just need to be even more precise than that. So the scientific world had to come up with something even more precise than the Earth itself in order to measure time. And so, just like the piano key that should vibrate at a certain frequency that should be very consistent in order to have an accurate representation of a musical note, science was looking for a substance that would be very stable, very consistent, that they could manipulate and measure in order to figure out how long 1 second was. And so great strides were made in the 20th century to make this happen. So it turns out, and I'm going to sort of give a really layman's explanation here, and I hope I don't slaughter the scientific accuracy of this explanation, but I'm going to explain a little bit about what an atomic clock is and how it works. The scientific community figured out that a substance called cesium-133 was very stable, very consistent, in certain conditions for them to be able to tell time. They take this substance, cesium-133, and they're able to manipulate it through a microwave cavity, microwave chamber of some sort. Within certain very specific conditions, as this cesium-133 moves through this microwave cavity, it will resonate or vibrate at a certain rate, a certain frequency. And very stable, very predictable, time after time, it will maintain this frequency. And as science is able to measure this frequency, they're able to use that as a reference for telling time. So just in case you want to memorize this number, officially in 1967, the scientific community decided that the length of 1 second is equal to this number, 9,192,631,770 oscillations of cesium-133 within these very specific conditions that exist inside these devices called atomic clocks. That's how long 1 second is, and in fact, it is so accurate that it's more accurate than the Earth itself. But this is a standard that science needed to determine in order to synchronize clocks for all kinds of different scientific applications around the world. So the bottom line really for all of us to know is that there is such a clock called an atomic clock, which is so accurate that it's not going to lose or gain 1 second in, say, millions of years, which for all practical purposes, we'll just say within our lifetimes, these clocks will never be wrong. All right. And knowing that such clocks exist helps us to do a lot of really interesting things with technology that were not possible before these kind of standards were invented. Now, there are other substances that can be manipulated to tell time. There's rubidium, there's hydrogen-based atomic clocks. In fact, even the cesium-133 kinds of clocks, there are advancements made every few years, and they make clocks that are even more accurate than the one they had before. And so there's a lot of great stuff going on. But, you know, bottom line, super accurate clocks exist. And we're able to tap into that and set all of our clocks to this super accurate time. So you've got your computer clock, you've got clocks around your house, your wristwatch, all these things are now able to tap into this atomic time standard. And that's pretty exciting for a guy like me who wants to have a clock that's set right down to the second, exactly perfectly right. Now, there is something that's far more common for timekeeping that most of us have in our houses and even on our wrists, and that's a quartz clock movement. Now, quartz is a very common mineral. You'll find it, you know, all over the place, and it's relatively inexpensive to harvest this stuff and to process this stuff and to be able to use it for different scientific applications. One thing that's extremely common today, and just, you know, over the last, maybe 30 years or so, these quartz clocks have become extremely common because they're relatively inexpensive to make. You can mass produce these things, and they're very good timekeeping devices. You see, quartz has certain electrical properties such that if you take a piece of quartz and you prepare it the right way and you place that inside a circuit just the right way and you put some electricity through that circuit, the quartz will resonate at a certain frequency, and that can be measured and that can be used to tell time. And this is how your little quartz clocks work, that you go down to Walmart and you spend, you know, $10 for a clock that you hang in your kitchen, put a AA battery in there, and it uses quartz to keep time. And it's a very good timekeeping device. It's not super, super accurate, but it's very good. You put a battery in there to last a year or two, and within that time, you know, the clock will probably keep good time accurately to within, I don't know, a couple minutes a year. And for most people, that's perfectly adequate. For a guy like me, not quite. But for most people, that's great, you know, especially if you have to, a couple of times a year, change your clock for daylight saving time adjustments. And, you know, that works pretty well. Quartz also is used in most wristwatches today that are battery powered. You get a little piece of quartz in the circuit there, and that keeps very good time on your wristwatch. But it's not perfectly accurate. So there must be something that could make that better for us. And of course there is. And I'll tell you about that in the next episode. Clocks that tap into that time from the atomic clock and correct themselves so that they're always even more accurate than your standard quartz clock. We'll talk about how that works on the next episode of the Atomic Timekeeping Podcast. Thanks for your time today, and if you have any feedback, any comments, questions, whatever, I do accept your emails. The email address is atomicelmer@gmail.com. Once again, atomicelmer@gmail.com. And if you'd like to give me your name and the city where you live, it might be fun to kind of share that with folks, and we'll find out where everyone is that might be listening to this podcast. And maybe I'll even quote a little piece of your email and share your fun comments and ideas with everyone else out there listening to this Atomic Timekeeping Podcast. Once again, thanks for spending a little bit of your time with me. I'm Greg Anderson, and I look forward to the next Atomic Timekeeping Podcast.